This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It's a new year, the year of the pig under the lunar calendar, but many of the same problems are following us as the calendar turns. Brexit remains a debacle, with a top European official mincing no words on just how bad it's gotten. Venezuela remains in turmoil, putting more attention on its neighboring countries. And climate change remains a global crisis, though now we have an even clearer picture of how critical it is. Plenty to make sense of this week on the Friday News Roundup. And joining us in studio to answer your questions is Peter Bergen, Vice President and Director of the International Security Program at New America. He's also a national security analyst for CNN and the author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you, Josh.
Also with us new to the Roundup is Dorothy Parvaz, the global politics reporter for Think Progress. Dorothy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we welcome back Shane Harris, the intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post. He's also a Future of War fellow at New America and the author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Shane, glad to have you back.
Thanks, Joshua.
We're also glad to get your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories from around the world. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream or tweet us at 1A. We begin in Venezuela. More than 40 countries, have now declared support for Venezuela's interim president, Juan Guaido. They include France, Spain, Germany, and as of this morning, Romania. But an attempt by the United States Agency for International Development to deliver $60 million in humanitarian aid was stopped at the border between Venezuela and Colombia. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro refused the aid, stating, quote, "We are not a country of beggars," unquote. Before we get to the humanitarian part, Shane Harris, let's start with the growing support for Juan Guaido. We spoke earlier in previous roundups about how the United States had come out in support of Guaido, and now there is this power vacuum in terms of the President Maduro, who won in this highly contested election, and Guaido, who's got the support of the opposition. Is it looking more or less likely that Maduro can hang on?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, he's hanging on in part by resisting the aid and also insisting that the United States is somehow trying to overthrow him and that there's essentially a Western-led plot to undermine him and take him out. So he's trying to rally popular support in that way. But from an international perspective, I think it's like the tide has already turned against him. There are now 47 countries. I mean, you know, the United Kingdom, Theresa May came out and said sanctions are still very much something that's on the table here. So there is really no, aside from, I think, you know, Russia and Cuba, kind of being some of the big powers, or if we can call them that, that are siding with him, most countries have turned against him. So in the international space, he has basically no support. And people are calling on him to have a free and open and fair and credible election, which is, of course, what did not happen before.
Although I understand, Shane, there's still a few countries that are kind of staying out of it. I think Italy and Ireland have withheld support. They haven't said one way or the other, right?
Right, but you've got, you know, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, the United States. I mean, these are really the big countries sort of on the international stage that matter and have the most clout. And I think that sentiment has clearly turned against Maduro.
Now, Peter, Maduro has been warning Washington about considering plans to intervene. It said that it will have blood on its hands if it does. I wonder if this is an idle threat or if there actually might be some bloodshed, considering that Maduro still mostly has the support of Venezuela's military.
Well, and that's the key thing. I mean, if he loses their support, then he's, you know, it's in a different situation. But, you know, the history of American military interventions in Latin America is not a super appealing set of interventions. Certainly, you know, we saw the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, with a kind of interesting notation about 5,000 troops to Colombia on one of his pads that a sharp-eyed journalist picked up. Now, what that means, I'm not quite sure. To me, it's very interesting that Elliot Abrams has been appointed special envoy to Venezuela, because Abrams is one of the people that was Tillerson, Secretary of State Tillerson, really wanted to be his top deputy. But because he'd written an anti-Trump article during the campaign, he couldn't be considered. The interesting thing about these special envoy roles is they don't need Senate confirmation. But here you have a very senior American diplomat who's been charged with kind of sorting this out. And I imagine, you know, the roll call of countries that that Shane just mentioned, I think is, you know, that shows that Abrams is, you know, being quite successful creating this kind of coalition that is against Maduro. But I think it's all moot. I don't think we're going to invade. And as long as he has the support of the military, I mean, basically he's in charge of the country.
It would seem also, Peter, I don't know if it's unlikely. I wonder what you think about whether it's unlikely, partly because Venezuela still has so much oil under the ground. And there are business interests that would like to be able to get into a peaceful Venezuela once all of this gets settled, to do business there. And if there's a military intervention, then that blows everything into chaos, potentially.
Yeah, and also Trump, of course, you know, came into office on a sort of ticket that we weren't going to do these kinds of interventions.
Yeah.
So, and there's no demand signal from the American public, as far as I can tell, for us to go in and enforce to this country.
Dorothy Parvaz, how do you see it?
Well, I mean, when we talk about Venezuela being an oil-rich country, it's also, you know, there's already international interest present there. China has some investments there and is not about to sit by and just watch, you know, this all go to hell in a handbag. But I mean, you know, when Maduro says we're not a country of beggars, we're not going to accept aid, it's not so much, I don't think, that he doesn't believe that there's a need in his country, but this aid is coming from the U.S. and it comes with strings attached. You know, as Peter pointed out, the U.S. has a really terrible history of military interventions, not just in Latin America, but everywhere in the world. It's never really worked out that well.
We've had some conversations on this program, by the way, for those of you who are interested in exactly what Dorothy is referring to. We've had a number of conversations on 1A about America's histories of military interventions and just what has gone wrong. You'll find those if you search on our website, the1a.org. That's the word, the number one, the letter A, dot org. Dorothy, let me stick with you as it relates to getting aid into the country. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke on that this week. Here is part of what he told the Fox Business Network on Wednesday.
Today, we tried to deliver humanitarian assistance from Colombia, from the United States and Colombia into Venezuela. And the Venezuelan military, under the direction of Mr. Madero, stopped that. Not only is he not allowing the economy to flourish, he is actively denying medicine and foodstuffs and hygiene kits for his own people. This is horrific stuff. And I think the Venezuelan people have had enough of it, and I'm confident that in the days and weeks ahead, they will continue to protest, continue to rise up.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking Wednesday on the Fox Business Network. So, Dorothy, what about that? This idea that the people will continue to protest, continue to rise up, perhaps that the aid that they're being denied will fuel the opposition even further?
Well, there's two ways to look at this. First of all, if we look at it from the context of Venezuela, sure. I mean, this might start turning the tide within the country where there is a need, and it might start putting pressure on the military to sort of step away from supporting Maduro, and that will really be the beginning of the end. Then we might see Maduro in exile in Cuba. We might see an election. But I think there's also the perspective of how little credibility the U.S. has when you see Secretary Pompeo saying, gosh, you know, Mr. Maduro, that he doesn't refer to him as President Maduro, Mr. Maduro is denying crucial aid. You know, this is, the U.S. is supporting Saudi Arabia in its war in Yemen, where the Saudi government has prevented very crucial humanitarian aid from reaching millions of Yemeni people. And we've seen millions of people facing hardships, hundreds of thousands starving to death and children. So when we talk about, you know, the importance of humanitarian aid reaching a place, the U.S. as a government just right now lacks credibility in acting like an agent that really cares about these things.
We're speaking to Dorothy Parvaz, global politics reporter for Think Progress, CNN national security analyst Peter Bergen, and Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post. We welcome your questions or thoughts on this or any of the big stories happening around the world this week, especially if you, like many people, have personal ties to Venezuela, whether it's through family or friends, business ties perhaps. What's your take on what's happening there are any of the big stories around the world? Email us, 1a@wamu.org. Gloria wrote on our Facebook page, "We sat on our thumbs with Nicaragua. Why such a big deal now with Venezuela?" And Molly wrote on our Facebook page, "Latin America is all over the news recently, but no one is talking about Nicaragua. Hundreds have been killed by Ortega's mercenaries, many more missing or have fled into exile." Shane Harris, interesting points. I think it is more accurate to say that Latin America is all over the English language news recently. I think if you look at, you know, Univision and Telemundo, which have formidable audiences of their own, it's not like this isn't being covered. It just kind of depends on where you look. These stories have been on NPR too. But I do take their point. Like, why now? Why is this an issue all of a sudden?
Well, it's interesting. We could actually go back to the 1980s, and we did quite a lot of things in Nicaragua, but that was a different time. But I think that what's happening now, and one way that we might look at this is, President Trump, despite his affinity for strongmen and autocrats, I mean, has always sort of positioned Maduro as, what you know, an adversary. And there is obviously tremendous oil wealth in Venezuela. The United States would like to see that country open and more friendly to Western companies, certainly international oil companies. The infrastructure was nationalized under Hugo Chavez, so that has been a long time that a lot of oil companies in this country have not been able to be in there. But I think this is also an opportunity for the Trump administration to just sort of isolate Maduro, which is something that they would like to be able to do, and point out that the humanitarian aspects of this, I mean, as we were saying earlier, that kind of is a little bit discordant given what we're doing in Yemen. But this is a regime that they have just pointed to as socialist, as, you know, leftist, and one that they would like to try and isolate. So it's that opportunity.
Bit more to discuss on Venezuela as we continue with Shane Harris, Peter Bergen, and Dorothy Parvaz. Pope Francis even offered to try to intervene in the conflict between Nicolas Maduro and Juan Guaido under the condition that both leaders agree to his involvement. We'll talk about that and about some of the other news involving the Catholic Church this week. As the Friday News Roundup continues, we'll get to more of your questions and comments as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Peter Bergen, national security analyst for CNN and author of United States of Jihad, Dorothy Parvaz, global politics reporter for Think Progress, and Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post and the author of a number of books, including The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories from around the world. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream, tweet us at 1A or email 1A at WAMU.org. Let's wrap up with Venezuela. Dorothy, there was a point you wanted to make.
Right. So I thought the listener made an excellent point about why is this such a big deal to us? Why is Venezuela a big deal to us? And part of it is that, you know, our adversaries, our challengers, however you want to see them, Russia, China, and Cuba, all have big roles in this country. So if we sort of don't intervene, well, you know, that's the thinking of the administration anyway, and don't try to exert some sort of control or influence. The thinking is, well, that's an area that we lose control of, right? So Russia, China, Cuba, their positions are strengthened in the region.
Now, in a press conference this week, Pope Francis offered to intervene in this conflict if both leaders agree to his involvement. Peter Bergen, does that seem likely? Might it make a difference? Is that just the thing you do out of sympathy, like, hey, man, I don't know what to do, but if I could help, just you know how to find me. Like, what is this?
I don't know, to be honest, Josh. I'm a big fan of Pope Francis on a lot of levels, but clearly he has much bigger fish to fry than simply Venezuela. And, you know, the Catholic Church is probably in the biggest crisis since the Reformation. So that's the Reformation was quite some time ago. But clearly this is an almost existential problem for the church in the United States in particular, I think, but in a lot of other European countries, whether you look at Ireland or Britain or pick your country. And you know, one of the topics that we were going to discuss is also this question of abuse of nuns. And, it, you know, there are cases in India, there are cases in, you know, around the world of this issue. That seems like that's the thing that should be in his inbox.
Yeah, before we get to that Catholic Church scandal, we will get to that. Let me get to a few more comments on Venezuela. John writes, every time the United States tries to intervene on behalf of oppressed people, it doesn't always go well. I think we should stop intervening. We should just stick with our allies. Scott writes, I understand why the U.S. would want to get involved in a situation like this, but of all the wrongdoings that go on around the world every year, how does the U.S. decide which ones to stand up against? There are many things we should have stood up for around the world, but did not. Shane, I think that's an excellent question. The stakes for the United States, it's not like Venezuela has an army that we're worried about, you know, rushing our borders. The concerns about a migrant caravan don't extend as far down as Venezuela. What is it? What's in it for the U.S. in being involved in this?
Well, I think you could actually make a moral argument on this one. I mean, you're talking about a country that should be enjoying tremendous wealth and prosperity given the oil that it has in the ground, in which inflation has reached, you know, almost unimaginable levels, and people literally cannot afford to buy the basic things they need to stay alive. So there is a humanitarian crisis that is there that I think is largely the function of probably of government mismanagement and some other functions as well. So there is that humanitarian argument. We've talked about the geopolitical strategic interest as well in making sure that countries like China don't come in and become the big kid on the block. We would like to avoid that as well. I don't know, though, that this administration has really articulated very well what is the interest. The fact that so many people are writing in and saying, wait, why are we worried about Venezuela? What's going on there? I think tells you that for as agitated as Secretary Pompeo gets and likes to poke Nicolas Maduro, this administration really hasn't come out and explained to the American people, why do we care?
Let's move on from Venezuela and talk about El Salvador. Nayib Bukele has been elected as El Salvador's new president. He's 37 years old, the former mayor of San Salvador, and he is the youngest president-elect there. He's also the first Muslim to be the president of El Salvador. Now, Dorothy, this election breaks a lot of historical ground. What's the other historical significance of this, other than just the fact that this guy is so unique?
Well, I mean, I think you pointed out the fact that this his background is completely different than anybody else. But it's also a break for the country in that he comes without the baggage of being so entrenched in a very corrupt and criminal sort of political system. Right. What I'm worried about is that now the Trump administration will start classifying this country as a Muslim country, and all the migrants coming from there will be classified as Muslim terrorists, frankly.
El Salvador is one of those countries in the Northern Triangle from which some of the migrant caravans were coming. But to the point that you made about the political establishment, he also does not come from these two big political parties, the Arena Party, which is on the far right, and the FMLN, which is on the far left. So, Dorothy, I guess the hope is that he can help El Salvador turn the page.
Well, that is definitely the case. I mean, he's the candidate of hope, I guess, is how people see it there, and that's how where he's at. But he's too inexperienced and too young right now for people to really know what he's going to be able to deliver. I mean, one of the key things he delivered was like beautifying San Salvador, making it pretty. Well, that's great, but you have drug cartels all over the place. You have mass crime. You have a lot of corruption. So you're going to need a lot more than cosmetic changes. So hopefully he will be able to deliver what people want.
That's kind of what I was wondering also, Peter. I don't know if this is a fair comparison. Correct me if it's not. But as I hear his story, I think about a guy like Emmanuel Macron, right? He's outside of the political establishment in France, kind of center left, comes from the world of business, has a little bit of appeal for a number of people, stands in opposition to someone like Marine Le Pen, who people were very afraid of having become the president of France. Then he wins office, very hopeful campaign. And then people start to get to know him, and they're like, maybe we don't like you as much as we think. It's almost the risk of being an idealistic outsider once the reality of politics and government set in.
Yeah, and I mean, France has problems, but it doesn't have problems on the scale that Dorothy referred to.
No.
I mean, Salvador is one of the most dangerous countries in the world. The reason these caravans are gathering is because people are desperate to leave. So, look, I mean, if he was a kind of combination of, you know, Winston Churchill and Mahatma Gandhi, I mean, you know, the problems are not – he's bound to disappoint, right, if the problems are too big. I mean, this is not something – Salvador has been in crisis now for several decades, and the problems seem to have got worse.
I'm still picturing if Winston Churchill and Mahatma Gandhi had it. That's too. I'm going to move on from that. Shane, I'm going to try to move on from that anyway. That image is too damn compelling. Is there anyone in this guy's corner? I mean, he's an outsider. Who's vouching for him? Who's pushing for him to succeed?
Well, he had 53% of the vote. So, I mean, obviously the people of El Salvador are pushing for him. And there was a repudiation of the traditional sort of two-party left-right system. Interesting, you know, he appeared on the night of the election with the former Attorney General of Guatemala, who was famous for prosecuting the president and vice president back in 2015, which led to their ouster. So I suppose you could say who's backing him is sort of the idea of a reformist movement in Latin America, that people who want to see a break with the system. I mean, he is very much, he's like a political brand, right? He shows up in jeans and a leather jacket. He is very self-stylized in that sense. So, I mean, I think he's really kind of riding that, you know, we call it the populist wave if you want, although that's a little bit reductive. But clearly, I mean, the majority of people in his country are rooting for him.
Different kind of populism than what we see, say, in parts of Europe.
Sure.
Mahatma Churchill? We'll move on. I swear we'll move on from this. We're speaking to Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst, Shane Harris of The Washington Post, and Dorothy Parvaz of Think Progress. Very serious story this week as it relates to the continuing scandal over abuse in the Catholic Church. Pope Francis has had to deal with that very directly. He was the first pontiff ever to visit the Arabian Peninsula, the birthplace of Islam. He delivered mass to a crowd of roughly 140,000 people in Abu Dhabi, including 4,000 Muslims. On the flight back to Rome, the Pope made more headlines by publicly acknowledging, for the very first time, the sexual abuse that was suffered by nuns at the hands of priests and bishops. The Pope acknowledged the abuse and said the church has been working on it, in his words, for some time. Dorothy Parvaz, what was the impact of him making this disclosure?
I think it actually angered people more because initially this was described as a form of sexual slavery what the nuns had to go through. And he tried to soften that language and said, no, it was more of they were being pressured. It was an abuse of power. And he said, well, you know, not everybody did this. Well, gosh, great. What? Are we just talking about massive sexual harassment and rape and sexual assault, but done by 10% of the clergy, 5%, 2%, what percent is acceptable? The softening of the language was just really shocking and I think further inflamed people.
Peter, there's also this meeting coming up in 2 weeks with bishops to deal with child sex abuse by the clergy. These meetings have been controversial in the past because, correct me if my memory's off, but the Pope has exerted pressure on other efforts around the church to try to take action on this. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops tried to address it during their meeting, and right before the meeting was about, like, seconds before the meeting was going to start, they get word from the Vatican saying, no, hold on, we're going to deal with this in February. So it seems like there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of attention that's going to be paid to this meeting to see what the Pope actually does, as opposed to just what the church says.
Yeah, I agreed. And when Pope Francis sort of took office, I think there was tremendous hope in the Catholic Church because he seemed to be quite a different pontiff than we've had in the past, and more willing to kind of grapple with the issues that have bedeviled the Catholic Church, and more really talking the message of Christ rather than just the sort of typical paper. That said, I think that he's being very slow on this the question of the sexual crimes of people in the church. So we'll see. I mean, you know, on the other hand, you know, you mentioned this going to the Emirates and celebrating Mass. It's a big deal. I mean, it says something about the Emiratis that they would allow this, and it says something about him that he did it. But still, it's a minor thing compared to this really enormous crisis of faith in the church because of the sexual activities of so many of the people who work in the church.
Shane, is there any sense of what the Pope might actually do? What kinds of actions he might take? That's been a little opaque for me through all this.
Yeah, and it's been fuzzy. I mean, he's obviously nodded towards it. He's acknowledged it, which I think everyone would agree is, okay, first step in forming some kind of a remedy. But it's not clear from what he said what that solution would be. And I mean, I think where his focus has been on trying to, you know, bring more people into the faith. I mean, there's this obvious problem with people leaving the church, and the Pope has become a global symbol of unity and understanding, and that's great for the message. But in terms of getting his own house in order, I mean, Peter used the right word. These are crimes. This is pervasive criminal activity that has spanned multiple continents over many decades, and it is something that he is very well aware of, having been a senior person in the church before he became the Pope. So he's not only having to deal with the public image of that, but also the fact that he knows very well what these problems are internally. And so I think if he's going to maintain this enormous credibility that he's had as the leader of the church and this goodwill, he's going to have to start putting some specifics on this.
Would love to hear from some of you who are Catholic. What would you like to see done, or what would you like to hear from Pope Francis with regards to all of this? 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Did you see the State of the Union address? One of the things you might have noticed that was not mentioned in President Trump's speech was climate change. Even though NASA just announced that 2018 was the fourth warmest year on record. According to NASA, 18 of the 19 warmest years have occurred since the year 2000. The four warmest have basically been among the four most recent warm year, most recent years. NASA and climate scientists at NOAA have said that even though last year was a little cooler than the three previous years, that is mostly due to random weather variations. And scientists warn that urgent action must be taken to reduce emissions. Dorothy Parvaz, these reports continue to come out from NASA, from NOAA, from federal climate scientists. I guess the question is when this becomes policy. There seems to be a little more energy toward making it policy, though not from the White House.
Oh, I think it'll become policy in this White House on the 12th of never. This is a president who spent most of his speech talking about the wall as a real national security threat, when even our own defense analysts and experts have said for years that climate change presents a major hole in our security and needs to be addressed. That is a national security threat. Running out of water is a national security threat.
There was also a disturbing report out of Asia this week. An intergovernmental organization based in Nepal that works with hundreds of scientists released a report. It said that a third or more of the glaciers of the Himalayas could be gone by the year 2100. Peter Bergen, can you give us a sense of how the rest of the world is dealing with some of this data, this increasingly clear picture of what climate change will look like and what it means for them if nothing's done?
Well, it's interesting. Countries like China, there's no denialism of climate change in so many countries that around the world. And, you know, I think when historians write about Trump, they will say that Trump fiddled while the world burned. And that basically, even if you accept, let's say you people listening to this program think that climate change isn't caused by human activity. Even if you accepted that, you could still say this is something that is happening we need to deal with, because there's a whole set of, the president did talk about infrastructure briefly in his speech. And so one of the big infrastructure projects is making cities like Miami like resilient to the fact that in 2050, good chunks of that city will be underwater. And, a lot of cities are actually, Miami is well aware of this problem, at least certain elements of it. So it just seems that there is an opportunity here that even if you don't accept the scientific massive consensus that human activity is causing this, that we need to prepare for this, whatever your views on that issue, because it's coming.
And beyond that, Shane, this is also a matter of national security. You've heard some members of the military establishment, the intelligence community speak very, I don't even know what the right word is, very passionately, very urgently about the
alarmingly.
Fact. Alarming, that's the right word, that climate change is literally a national security crisis.
Absolutely. I mean, this has been the case for years now. Every year, we just had one recently, there's this thing called the Worldwide Threats Briefing that the intelligence chiefs go up to Capitol Hill and say, basically, these are the 10 things keeping us all awake at night. Climate change has been on that list for a number of years, because when sources of water dry up, as they might in this area of the Himalayas, these glaciers, people die. They fight. They dislocate. There's mass migration. There's movements. I mean, we're talking about sort of the basic sort of fundamental elements of human security quite literally evaporating. That's a national security problem, and it's something that has been not just this administration, but previous ones have been warning about, and you just haven't seen any action on it.
I should note, by the way, we did speak to Congressman Ro Khanna and Kathy Castor about the Green New Deal that Democrats proposed. You can listen to that online at the1a.org. Also, next week we'll be on the road. We'll be visiting my home state of Florida, specifically Tampa, St. Petersburg, to talk about how climate change might be affecting that area. We welcome your thoughts about how climate change is affecting where you live and what's being done or what should be done to protect your home for the future. Feel free to leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. More of the Roundup in a moment. Stay close. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Peter Bergen, Dorothy Parvaz, and Shane Harris. Still a bit more time to get some of your questions and thoughts in. Tweet us at 1A about any of this week's big stories from around the world that caught your eye or that you have questions about. You can also comment on our Facebook page or email 1A@WAMU.org. Dorothy, there was a point you wanted to make with regards to climate change. Go ahead.
Right. I mean, one of the hallmarks of this administration is how short-sighted it is. So basically, the president only cares about his next poll, sort of to see how he's doing, the next tweet, the next election cycle. He's just not that concerned about what's going to happen to this planet in 3 years, 2 years, or even in 6 months.
He's also been very vocal about his skepticism on the causes of climate change, which we are not debating on this program. The evidence is overwhelming, so we are not going to debate that human actions are the primary cause of climate change. If you want to debate that, you're listening to the wrong show. But Peter, it's also important to note that there are a lot of companies around the world that are very clear that they want to be engaged in this. I mean, there is, to just be crass, there's a fortune to be made in dealing with climate change.
Well, I'll tell you, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is going to make big investments in solar energy. I mean, so they're
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of all places.
A lot of oil there.
Right. A lot of oil there, but then also a lot of business to be done.
Moving away from that, absolutely. I mean, the company that comes, this is why major energy companies are investing in alternative energy, because there's a fortune to be made in it. And by the way, they all agree that humans cause climate change, and they understand their product is a major contributor to that.
I will say, by the way, we are settled on this program that human actions do cause climate change. But we've also had some discussions about how you discuss climate change, because it's thorny when you just try to talk about it. You'll find that conversation also online at the1a.org. Can we back up to the Catholic Church story for 1 second? Because Patricia in Chicago brought up a worthwhile point that I think is worth picking apart just slightly. Patricia writes, what should the Pope do? Call law enforcement now. I think, Dorothy, that gets sticky depending on where in the world you are. We've spoken to some Catholic priests who say their new guidance from their bishops and archbishops is, if you find out about something that's happened, call law enforcement immediately. You don't even have to tell us first. Call law enforcement. But depending on where you are around the world, building that consensus, I feel like there's a challenge there.
And isn't that messed up, that you need that kind of some kind of consensus to say that sexual assault is wrong?
Yeah. Well, and then there's law enforcement.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, these are crimes. I mean, we said this before. I mean, when they've happened in the United States, I mean, priests have gone to jail and been prosecuted for this. There's obviously a system and a culture within the Catholic Church that protects people in societies. We can go back to, you know, the clergy abuse scandal in Boston that was told in the movie Spotlight, if you want to get a sense of how deep sometimes communities protect themselves. But it's important to remember, I mean, these members of the clergy, they're not above the law. I mean, when they commit crimes in a jurisdiction, they can be prosecuted. And while the Vatican or the Holy See, you know, is a sovereign nation, the Catholic Church is not. It's not the same thing. And so we have to be very clear about the jurisdictional lines and boundaries here. I don't know why, I mean, to echo what Dorothy said, why it should be controversial if a priest in Washington, D.C. finds that, you know, another priest is sexually abusing children, why would you not call the police?
Dorothy?
Well, I mean, I suppose with the, you know, the issue might be that in some countries, what constitutes rape or who can be protected or prosecuted are different. But I mean, I think that the church can definitely call back their clergy, people who have committed these crimes, to a jurisdiction where they can be held accountable. They don't have to be prosecuted necessarily locally.
Let's talk a bit about Brexit. Donald Tusk is the president of the European Council, and he did not mince words when telling reporters how he felt about a no-plan Brexit.
By the way, I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it safely.
a special place in hell. Those are the words of European Council President Donald Tusk. Those comments came after a meeting between President Tusk and the Prime Minister of Ireland, Leo Varadkar, who was caught on a hot mic afterwards telling Mr. Tusk, quote, "They'll give you terrible trouble in the British press for that," unquote. Peter Bergen, did they give him terrible trouble?
I mean, he got criticized, but, you know, the definition of a gaffe in Washington is telling the truth in public. This is, I think, telling the truth in public. And, you know, the pound has lost 20% of its value since the vote in June 2016. And I think the markets are a pretty good kind of way of judging, like, if this is a good deal for the British economy and public. And the markets are speaking. And if there is a hard Brexit, so-called, on March 29th, if they don't get a deal together, the pound is going to drop a lot further.
How far along are we, Shane, in terms of trying to get a deal together? There had been a previous vote on a plan, didn't go far. Theresa May's been trying to work something out. That hasn't gone well. The possibility that the European Union might just have to rip away from the UK and figure it out as they go along seems real. And it's understandable why Ireland is concerned, because the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland would be a gigantic problem if there's no deal. How close or far are we from a deal?
Well, I think the question of the predicting is dangerous in this, and throughout the debate over the Brexit, you've even heard, you know, the smartest commentators in Great Britain saying we do not know what is going to happen. And I think that is genuinely an answer here. But it is looking more likely as the deadline approaches and there is no deal that you're going to have a hard Brexit. And what you're seeing with Tusk in that comment there is the frustration that the EU has, I think, with the way that the British government has been approaching this and sending the message, like, do not expect us to bail you out here. We offered you a deal. Your prime minister took it back. You don't want that deal. We're done. We're done making deals. And Theresa May has said that as well. So it's, you know, I don't want to predict, but it's looking increasingly likely that the hard Brexit is going to be the reality.
And I think, Dorothy, that's important to clarify for folks who may not be following this granularly, exactly why Donald Tusk is so important in this. He's kind of, for lack of a better way to describe it, he's kind of the voice of Europe in a way, in terms of the UK's negotiation and trying to come up with something that the EU member states will sign off on.
Well, correct. And the thing is, they've already negotiated this deal with the EU member states. So the EU didn't want the UK to leave. They decided they're going to do it for some, I have no idea how that passed, why the voters really voted for it, but they did. And so, you know, the deal's been hammered out, and having Theresa May keep going back to try and get a different deal is just a non-starter. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if they went for a second vote, like put it basically before the voters again. But, of course, this would be terribly embarrassing for the government, because they're basically saying, yeah, we gave you this thing to vote on. We had no way of delivering it, and we can't deliver it. So although we're calling this a vote, please vote no, because the yes isn't going to work out.
Right. What some people, I think, have been revoting Brexit, what some people have been calling a regrexit vote. But I also kind of am taken, Peter, by the fact that Donald Tusk said this out loud. Like, it sounds like he's just kind of let his id out for what a lot of people have been thinking, and he's reached a point where he's tired of being diplomatic about this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if there's an unintended consequence of all this, which is that other countries have been talking at some point about leaving the EU, or, you know, there's a lot of frustration about Brussels micromanaging economies and that kind of thing. But I think that the Brexit experience in Britain, any country who looks at that will say, actually, we're better in than out.
Well, we will not speculate on what's going to happen with Brexit. I think one week we had a soundbite from a British reporter. They asked him, you know, what can you tell us about whether to negotiate and what's going to happen? And the soundbite was basically him going, look, I have no... it was basically the entire soundbite, so nobody knows where that's going to go. One thing in the world economy that seems a little bit clearer is who the new president of the World Bank might be. President Trump announced his pick for the World Bank president. It's a guy named David Malpass. He's an alumnus of the George H.W. Bush administration and the Reagan administration. Convention dictates that the U.S. gets to choose who runs the World Bank. Shane, I'd like your take on David Malpass, particularly because he has been openly critical of the World Bank in the past, and now it looks like he might get to be the guy in charge.
Right. Usually you don't pick somebody who has said that the institution is, you know, rife with problems to then go run it. He had a quote in to a House subcommittee in 2017, which kind of captures the sentiment and also helps understand why he's so appealing to President Trump, where he said, "Globalism and multilateralism have gone substantially too far to the point that they are hurting U.S. and global growth." That's very much a neat encapsulation of how Donald Trump views the world, views free trade, how he's approached, you know, deals with China, et cetera. So in that sense, Malpass is right there on the same page with him. And so he would bring a very different kind of operating principle to the bank, which is there principally to give loans to developing nations and to, you know, kind of extend the wealth that way. Somebody who is just a fundamental skeptic of the whole proposition on which the bank is based. So that it really is out of the norm, but sounds just right to President Trump, I think.
But can we take a step back, though, Shane? I hear you. I mean, there are plenty of people in the administration who are definitely contrarians to the mainstream of how those jobs are done. You know, you have Betsy DeVos as the Secretary of Education, who's very much in favor of charter schools and private education. You have Rick Perry, the Secretary of Energy, who did not have a clear picture of what the Energy Department did before he got the job. You have John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, who is very much a hawk. But is it just the Trump administration, or does the U.S. have longer kind of legacy drama with the World Bank? Is this a U.S. thing? Is this a Trump administration thing?
Well, there's certainly, I mean, it's not necessarily been a completely smooth relationship with the World Bank. And we should emphasize, too, it's not that, you know, Malpass is uninitiated in the ways of the global economy. I mean, he understands how things work. It's not like they appointed a neophyte for the position. It's just that I think he takes a view that is very much at odds, perhaps, with what the bank's sort of raison d'etre would be, and is very much in line with this, you know, isolationist proposition that President Trump has been putting forward. That's not, by the way, something that, I mean, most presidents in the past have been pro-globalization, pro-free trade, pro-developing world loans. You haven't seen somebody sort of fundamentally hostile to the mission of the World Bank quite like this.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. President Trump made a speech to the State Department this week about the future of the fight against the Islamic State, which continues to hold territory in Afghanistan, Libya, the Sinai, and West Africa. Here's part of what the president said.
Should be formally announced sometime, probably next week, that we will have 100% of the caliphate.
As part of the president's address to the State Department this week, he added that only remnants of the caliphate still remain, but that, in his words, quote, remnants can be very dangerous, unquote. Dorothy, what does that mean? When he says 100% of the caliphate, what is he referring to? Territory, fighters, you know, the ideology? What's he talking about?
Well, if he's referring to fighters, then he's contradicting the Pentagon's own report that there are roughly 30,000 ISIS members remaining in the Levant region and are basically waiting to find a way to sort of reemerge as either with a different name or under a different flag. So I'm guessing he's talking about territory, but even that's not 100% correct.
And there's also, Peter, the president has come under fire for announcing the troop withdrawal from Syria. Is that still happening? That's still in the works, right?
Yeah, it's got to be finished by April now is the latest on that. And then also there's this strange thing about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which is sort of out there in the atmosphere, but it's not really clear if a formal order has been given, and sort of it tends to undercut. If the Taliban's principal goal is getting rid of American troops and you say preemptively we're going to take American troops out, seems like you're losing a lot of leverage at the negotiating table. And by the way, Joshua, as you recall, one of the principal arguments of Trump on the campaign trail is Obama kept making mistakes by signaling military moves, potential withdrawals, and this is basically exactly the same thing. So it's very puzzling to me why he does this.
Just to clarify with regards to what you're saying on Afghanistan, you're talking about these negotiations between the U.S. and elements of the Taliban that might allow for some kind of peace deal and kind of a new way forward between the Taliban and the Afghan government.
Yeah, but even as that process is happening, we're hearing these reports of maybe that half the American troops will be pulled out or some number. It's a little unclear, but it seems like a strange thing to put out there when you're having a negotiation on precisely this topic and you're just giving away this principal demand that they have without getting anything in return.
Another interview the president gave, for those of you who watched some of the run-up to the Super Bowl, in the interview that he gave to Margaret Brennan on CBS, President Trump declared his intention to keep U.S. troops in Iraq so that they can monitor Iran. Iraqi President Barham Saleh later rejected this plan, stating, quote, Iraq does not want to be a party or access to any conflict between multiple countries, unquote. Shane Harris, what about this? What might this mean for the U.S. relationship with Iraq? I mean, can the U.S. do this if the Iraqi government doesn't want it?
Well, we should remind people that Iraq and Iran have a history, a very contentious one,
very
obviously. And so, you know, the president really, I think, kind of, this is an example here where he maybe didn't read the briefing before he, you know, sort of stepped in it and sort of making policy on the fly. I mean, ultimately, look, if the government of Iraq says we're not going to allow your soldiers to be based here, or we're not going to agree to the terms, they can't be based there. But what the president is saying, I think he's trying to suggest that somehow they're there for some kind of like reconnaissance mission or just to keep an eye on Iran. There's lots of ways the U.S. intelligence community keeps an eye on Iran that don't involve thousands of troops being positioned in Iraq. And I think the government of Iraq hears that and says, whoa, whoa, hold on a second. You're proposing, it sounds to us, like using us as a base for you to go attack Iran. And that's a non-starter for them.
Dorothy?
Well, I mean, first of all, the base is on the wrong side of the country to watch Iran. It's closer to the border with Syria. And, you know, while it's true that Iran and Iraq do have a contentious history, there was a very long war, they also have a relationship that is workable and has to be because they are neighbors. As the Iraqi president pointed out, we live here. Right. So Iran lives there. Iraq lives there. They need to get along. And Iraq is very much aware, and the president should be as well, President Trump, that is, that without the support of Iran, the Hashd al-Shaabi, the Shia militia, you know, would not have been able to fight ISIS as effectively as they did, as the Iraqis did.
Dorothy Parvaz, global politics reporter for Think Progress. Dorothy, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Peter Bergen, vice president and director of the International Security Program at New America, also national security analyst for CNN, and author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
And Shane Harris, future of war fellow at New America, intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post, and the author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. Thanks, Shane.
Thanks, Joshua.
Our senior team is Lindsay Foster Thomas, Danielle Knight, Gabe Bullard, and Denise Couture. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you Monday from St. Petersburg, Florida. This is 1A.